Hello and welcome to another Investec Focus podcast brought to you by Investec Cash Investments. This is the third episode in our savings series, following insights from the Investec Gibbs Savings Index. Join us today as we hear from our panel, who will unpack both the financial and psychological aspects of retirement.
In 2019, the concept of retiring at 65 seems archaic, doesn't it? Well, no one had even thought of retiring 100 years ago. And it was Otto von Bismarck, no less, who came up with the concept. But then the average life expectancy, believe it or not, was 35. So reaching retirement was the exception, definitely, rather than the rule. And today, not reaching 65 is the exception. Although many individuals' mindsets and savings practices regarding retirement remain virtually unchanged. I'm Jenny Cruis-Williams, and I'm joined today by Dr. Adrian Saville, Professor of Economics at the Gordon Institute of Business Science. Adrian, please give us a macro view of where we are as a country when it comes to savings. And are we as bad as rumor has it?
The key argument behind the savings index that we build recognizes that savings and investment is one of the key ingredients, one of the founding pillars of building inclusive and sustaining economic growth. When it comes to South Africa's performance, we are regrettably well off the pace. So the way the index is constructed is to score a country out of 100, with 100 putting you into the shape of what we would call savings miracles, countries that have transformed. In the most recent index print, South Africa comes in with a score of 63.7. Now, whilst that is low relative to the others, these so-called miracles, pleased to report that it is a marked improvement on late 2018 and the early print of 2019.
Do we know why?
Well, the index is made up of three core components. So the headline number is a 63.7. And rather than getting hung up on what exactly 63.7 what, I think it's helpful to recognize that 63.7 is a score that's made up of three underlying components, what we call a stock, a flow, and an environmental factor. And the stock is all of our collective efforts over many years. This is the pool of savings that we've got to work with. The flow is how we're doing in any moment in time, whether we're contributing to that pool or taking away from the pool. And the environment is the broad set of factors that are either supporting or taking away from that flow factor. Importantly and encouragingly, all three factors have improved in the first part of 2019. And it's the first time in a number of years that we've seen this type of coordinated upturn, which I really take as an encouraging sign, not of euphoria or sudden emergence into miracle stages, but certainly an improvement on where we were 12 or 18 months ago.
So, Adrian, what have been some of the key findings with regards to old age dependency in the South African context?
Unfortunately, not much different than the global findings, which is heading into retirement based on growing life expectancy, you can expect to run out of money. That savings behaviors and retirement practices and habits haven't shifted with advances in medicine and science. So if we go back to your intro, Jenny, where you referenced the Otto von Bismarck's intervention, where he proposed a pension in what was then the Prussian state. If you hit 60, there would be a pension. At that time, life expectancy for women was 35 and for men it was 32. Your chance of hitting 60 was, that was an outside chance. And what's curious is that our practice of that being the retirement age hasn't really moved over 100 years. It might have shifted up to 65 or 68 over time, but overwhelmingly, medicine and science have got us out of life expectancies of 35 into life expectancies of, in some of the more advanced countries, early 80s, and we're still retiring as if, you know, the money that we've got is going to be enough. But it's based for a different existence, a different person. And overwhelmingly, the evidence globally is that retirees will run out of money before they run out of time.
But does that mean that, for instance, if you're in formal employment, that the companies themselves who put together a pension plan for the employees, are they out of date?
Well, retirement practices have also shifted from what we call defined benefit to defined contribution. So historically, under defined benefit, when you retired, the company that you'd have worked for would be obliged to look after you until you died. And if you had a surviving significant other, then they would have to look after that person. In recent times, this practice has shifted to defined contribution, where you and I are required to save in anticipation of retirement. If we moved companies, then those savings should shift with us. If you take the OECD countries, what we call a replacement ratio, when you retire, how much have you got in your pot? How much of your last income can you expect to have in year one of retirement? That's what we call a replacement ratio. And in the OECD countries, it sits at 60%. In other words, if you're earning 100 as a fresh retiree, you will shift down to 60. The replacement ratio in South Africa sits closer to 20%.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, it's a dire number, and I think dire might be a cheerful observation.
So looking at the concept of the gig economy, the idea of freelance, flexible, on-demand work, rather than the more traditional 9-to-5 working mode, if it still exists, I guess, how is this being used by people who have retired? I mean, I prefer to use the word mature workers somehow rather than retirees, but explain that to us.
If you take the earlier point about the replacement ratio, it suggests that in retirement, you're going to have to look for alternative sources of income to supplement your living, and the gig economy is a place that people could go. However, the gig economy is not just sort of post 65 finding ways to add to diminished income. Gig economy is increasingly a work model, and that applies to 15 to 65 year olds, what we would call the labor force. So the gig economy, I think, is relevant to all age groups. And what matters here, if you're post 65, is how do I supplement my income? If you're sub 65, it's not just about how do I earn an income, but how do I make sure that what I'm doing here is also building a retirement plan so that when I do hit 65 or 70 or whatever your retirement age is, you have built a financial resource that you can rely on to achieve that replacement ratio that we referred to.
I mean, 65 really is the new 40. Let's say, well, 45, let's stretch it a little bit. Because I think the majority of people are really fit at that age. I think that maybe, and I'd be interested to see and hear what you're saying about it. I'm not sure that companies themselves keep up with the fact that they could keep people on after the age of 65, maybe working
on
contract.
I think that's exactly the point, that longevity, medicine, science have advanced ahead of business practice and indeed ahead of human behavior. Even if I speak to my kids who are teenagers and I ask them about retirement, they are already, as teenagers, referencing 60, you know, as a retirement age. This is bizarre. Their life expectancy is probably in the order of 100 years.
Well, of course, 100 years is another conversation altogether. I mean, what do you do between, let's say, 65 and 100 years? I mean, do you keep your teeth, for instance?
I think there is another aspect, and we pick this up in the Investec Gibbs Index, is dependency ratios. And the dependency ratio on an income earner, where are our parents in the equation? And we should add in that our parents-in-law. And where are our kids in the equation? And emphasis on education means that kids are staying at home longer. A global aspect of increasingly elevated youth unemployment means that not only are your kids staying at home longer, but they're staying at home longer without income. And your parents are going into retirement at 65 and then staying in retirement for longer because of life expectancy.
Well, can I ask a question? Given the profile of the South African population and the number of young people in South Africa, which is certainly going to outnumber the mature people and old people, it probably already does. What do you do with kids who can't even earn a living?
Yeah. So South Africa has this challenge of being a young country with a high youth unemployment rate. So half of our population is younger than 25 years old. And of those who are potentially in the workforce, one in two can't find employment. And if you can't find work, then you don't have income, which means your ability to save for retirement or any other financial element is nil. One of the issues then that we are addressing in the Investec Gibbs Index is how South Africa breaks this gridlock of low savings rate, low investment rates, troubled by low financial literacy. And if we can shift behaviors and patterns, it's not a miracle. It's not magic. The cocktail is available. It's about us putting our hands on those ingredients and then getting them into action. That's exactly what we set out to do in building this work.
We can't be the only country in the world, surely, that have got a high number of youngsters and probably many of them out of work. I mean, are there successful countries, I'm wondering?
There's many examples, and one of the things that we're at pains to do in the work that we've published is to draw on experiences and examples rather than, you know, hypotheticals and theorizing, imagining what's possible. So this isn't fanciful daydreaming. It's rather going to other countries that have demonstrated how you shift these practices and behaviors. And one of the examples that we draw on is how you change the behavior amongst school children. Saving is a learned behavior, and if you can learn to save as a child, you might be set for life. And one of the intriguing examples that we find is an experiment or an exercise with what they call chatter. And chatter is social media noise, where if you can get children to talk about their savings behavior, their savings discipline. It's not about the numbers. It's not about the rands and the cents. It's about the fact that they are disciplined and they're making a contribution. And then they can boast about that or demonstrate that on social media. And then you reward that behavior in school cafeterias. And through that, start to shift
behaviors. It's a great idea. Yes, and I think it's wonderful going through schools. I can remember being given a savings box by my parents. And when I was very broke, I wanted to get my money out. And it was cunning because the bottom of the box was there were teeth, so I thought if I put a knife in there and jiggle it enough, could I get it out? And tantalizingly, you could see the beginning of the coin never came out. You couldn't touch it. So I'd be interested, what does the research say about people who have retired and suddenly they want to go on working, they don't know what to do? But isn't it a wonderful opportunity to have to think, I've always wanted to do woodwork, or I've always wanted to, I don't know, go dancing or something. I'm being frivolous about it. But think of Uber, think of Airbnb, think of companies like that that have come out of nowhere. There are opportunities in today's world.
Absolutely, Jenny. There's the prospect of the gig economy and finding more suited work. There is also the prospect of companies shifting their behavior. BMW is an example that's gone in this direction, taking people out of work that might be more suited to a 50-year-old and shifting their tasks and requirements at 60 and even late 60s into early 70s, reducing the work week from 5 days to 3 days for a 72-year-old. That might suit your circumstance. There is also the contribution that people with 20, 30, 40 years experience can make to interns and mentorship. The presumption is that the only way that you get space for a person coming into the workforce is by pushing someone out. The evidence says the exact opposite, that the people who are at the end of careers might have as massive contribution to make to building new skill. And then Ken Robinson has done lovely work on demonstrating or illustrating examples of second and third careers, that we are quite capable of reinventing ourselves, not once, but often twice or even three times.
Are we going to have to bring in legislation to protect your personal savings? Because we all get broke. Kids need school fees and things like that. What do we do about that? Do we need legislation? Say, no, you can't touch it.
Well, I think, you know, that's probably a conversation for, you know, a different time. No part of this is advocating that, you know, we should shift into exploitative practices, and the gig economy is certainly vulnerable to that. So I would agree with you. If I could rewind to an earlier point about legislation, my ears pricked up there. I want to go back to that, because as much as we might be able to legislate better savings retirement practices, I actually don't think the issue sits with legislation as much as it sits with our behaviors and our decisions. So how do we build a much healthier retirement? We get saving earlier, we consume less, we save more. When we shift jobs, we don't cash out. And if you can get those basics of savings and retirement practices right, you don't need better legislation, you just need better behavior.
What about fire? Is this also street lingo?
So this is reference to a movement that has gained in popularity, the suggestion being that if you can live on the smell of an oil rag, you can probably pack down most of your income into a savings pot. And if you can put away enough of it in early years of employment, you might be able to retire as young as 35 or 40 years old. And then if you don't aspire to an affluent, over-the-top retirement, but if you can maintain a modest lifestyle, then early savings plus compounding gives you the ability to retire at 40 and afford yourself for a very, very long time.
We were talking a little bit earlier on about countries that seem to have got it right financially. You mentioned Chile, and I know a little bit about Singapore. Maybe we can talk about those countries. Why have they got it right? How is it right? What are they doing?
One part is the reference to practices and behaviors that in Singapore, you have no choice. You will contribute to a pension fund. The company matching of your pension fund translates into a pension contribution that amounts to about 30% of income. So each year, you are putting away 30% of income. And then inside of that retirement program, they have some fascinating aspects, including being able to draw on your pension to fund the purchase of a house, being able to draw on your pension to fund education, and later in life, being able to draw on your pension to fund medical, which means that at the same time that you're making a contribution to your retirement plan, you're effectively turning into a banker for your own mortgage. You're funding yourself. And it puts the asset and the liability, which in most of our circumstances is the asset is my retirement fund, the liability is my bank loan on my home, it puts them together in the same pot. And that asset liability matching translates into quite grand shifts in affordability and the cost of funding. Allow that, the point about compounding, give that time, give those savings on funding time to compound, and you've got an affluent society.
So Singapore society doesn't have a reputation for being laissez-faire. Mm. You will do what you're told or else. I mean, if you drop a cigarette or a piece of paper on the street, somebody's going to smack you and whatever. I mean, what is our chance of being able to do that here in South Africa, where we contest virtually every single thing?
I think that the prospect, you know, I hear you being sort of cynical or reserved in imagining that we could do this. I would agree, you know, with you that our, and the point has been made about financial literacy, and I would add to financial literacy, economic literacy, and our chances of securing those types of financial freedoms and economic mobility probably corresponds with building financial literacy and economic literacy. Until we've been able to achieve that, I think we're unlikely to see, you know, a Singaporean miracle.
Well, what about Chile? What are they doing?
Well, they did something less adventurous, but certainly firm-handed. And the requirement was everyone would contribute to a pension fund. You couldn't cash out, so your pension fund migrated with you. They also shut down the optionality of the investment industry, and that they obliged all pension fund providers to essentially offer to their clients passive solutions, market matching solutions. Only in more recent times have they built sort of more exotic or elaborate solutions. So the emphasis in Chile was you will contribute to a pension fund. That pension fund will migrate with you. The performance of the fund will match the market. So it doesn't sponsor sort of advertising or gaming who you can go with for your retirement solution. And then they drove costs out of the system, which adds that sort of final piece of zing to the compounding component.
I'd like to talk very, very briefly as we come to the end of this conversation about the psychological angle of retiring. I have seen bullish businessmen loving the first week of retirement and going and fishing. My own father did that. And then the second week, he was thinking, well, okay, well, I'll fit a bit of golf in. My mother was saying, I've never experienced anything so terrible as having him at home the whole time with nothing much to do. Psychologically, retirement for many people is extremely difficult.
Mortality rates are highest in the first year after retirement.
Exactly.
Which says to you, if you want to stay alive, don't retire. Work yourself to death. That's a colorful throwaway. But I think what it does speak to is the purpose that people get from work. And to be more serious about the purpose people get from work is to recognize that as much as your mortality risk might rise in the first year after retirement, there is also a social risk. To make a more serious point of this, we also need to recognize the importance of getting young people who are currently excluded from participation in the workforce to get them into workforce participation so that they can be part of this privilege of having a purpose-filled and purpose-fed career.
You are going to retire in a week's time. What is the one thing that you would love to do?
Well, it's a hypothetical, Jenny, because I'm not going to retire. Knowing my personality, I think I would find retirement exceptionally hard. People will often suggest, you know, well, when I retire, I'm going to travel the world. That's wonderful. You know, if you can afford that, it's a lovely privilege to have. I genuinely don't think retirement is on my agenda. I'm going to keep active and engaged. An area where I get significant fulfillment from and hopefully make a material contribution is through teaching, which might be a variation on mentoring. So that's where I think I could remain active for a very long time and give a lot back to society.
Well, I have loved this conversation. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
This was a podcast brought to you by Investec Cash Investments. Thank you for listening. We hope you'll join us again next time on Investec Focus. Be sure to comment, rate, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts.
The views expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm and should not be taken as advice or recommendation. Investec Specialist Bank, a division of Investec Bank Limited, is a registered credit provider.